If you've been to the Grand Canyon, or even if you've only seen pictures, you've probably wondered, how did that big hole in the ground get there? Well, it's not simple, and geologists are still arguing about the basics. This hour, we'll talk about the puzzling geology of the Grand Canyon and some of the scientific detective work being done to figure out when, why, and how it was carved. Plus, perched on a mesa just above Flagstaff is the famous Lowell Observatory, one of the oldest in the U.S., founded back in the days of the Wild West. We'll take a look at some of its historic discoveries, like Planet X, later known as Pluto, and all the exoplanets it's spotting today. It's all coming up after this break. Stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to squarespace.com and enter the coupon code ScienceFriday9.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're broadcasting live today from Flagstaff, Arizona, and just north of here is, of course, the Grand Canyon, one of the most beautiful and awesome gashes on the face of the planet. And if you're like me, you probably assume that the canyon was carved out by a river running through it, just like the Colorado does today. Well, that's sort of true, but the story's a bit more complicated. But like most things in life, the devil is in the details. And for over a century, geologists have been puzzling over how and when the canyon formed. The earliest American to lead a river expedition through the Grand Canyon was Major John Wesley Powell, who set out in August 1869 with several wooden boats and a month's supply of flour, bacon, dried apples, and coffee. He went on to describe in detail the rock formations he found, what the cliff walls were made of, and, of course, the lively rapids. We've learned a lot since Powell's trip, but there are still some points of debate. For example, some geologists dispute the age of the canyon. Others, the reason it even began forming in the first place. Will we ever be able to answer these questions definitively? Are some of these mysteries of the canyon lost in the rocks, carried away long ago by the river? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and if you're in the audience here, don't be shy, step up to the microphone. And you get to ask that question you've always wondered about the Grand Canyon, but no one was here to answer. They're here to answer today, and let me introduce them to you. Carl Kullstrom is a professor of structural geology and tectonics at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Kullstrom.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Eva Lokita is an emeritus scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey. He's also a research associate at the Museum of Northern Arizona here in Flagstaff. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Lokita.
Thank you.
Richard Young is a professor of geological sciences at the State University of New York in Geneseo. He joins us from WXXI in Rochester. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Young.
Thank you, Ira.
Carl, let me begin with you first and talk about why is the canyon so mysterious to geologists? It seems right there. It's river running through it. Seems simple.
Yes. Well, I suppose an even deeper question is why is it so fascinating to the world's public? But to answer the question of why it's mysterious, I don't think it really is that mysterious. I think that, as you said earlier, the basic ideas of how a river carves through rock to carve a canyon are well understood. The timing of how it happened, I think, is reasonably well understood. Maybe the age of the canyon, in my opinion, is very well understood. But the events that led to the carving of the canyon, I think, are challenging because, as you said, it's an erosional landscape, and the record is being carried away. So as you go farther back into the history of this iconic landscape, I think the evidence becomes more fragmentary and there's much more room for discussion and debate about how we got to where we are now. Mm.
Richard Young, your work on the Grand Canyon began at the same time as Evo's 50 years ago when you discovered that rivers around there used to flow east and not west as they do today. How's that possible? How'd you find that out?
Well, I was sent out to work on a different problem altogether. But eventually, over a period of years, became obvious that there was another canyon right next to the existing canyon, which is kind of amazing since all the erosion that has occurred. So it just kind of gradually emerged that there was a much older story, but we had a hard time getting the actual age confirmations until, in fact, only about a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Ivo, your research on the Grand Canyon was sort of a plug at the western edge of the canyon, correct? Where the Colorado couldn't have flowed before a certain time.
The immovable object.
So how certain can we be of the age of the Grand Canyon based on that immovable object?
Well, I think one has to start by defining a few terms. The history is very complicated, and we should be talking about the Grand Canyon that we see today and the Colorado River that we see today. Mm-hmm. But in reality, these are just the last episode of a long chain of events stretching back millions, if not tens of millions of years. So it is, one really has to say, how much departure from what we see today will we accept and still view it within the same framework? Now, the river that we see today, because of the immovable object at the mouth, and let me explain to the audience what that would be, it is a sequence of deposits that were laid down under conditions of interior drainage. You can get the mental picture of that by going to any basin in Nevada, apply at the bottom, no river flowing through it. Those are the kinds of deposits that you see at the mouth of the Grand Canyon. And they have a day, an age that has been debated, but we're zeroing in on it. For sure, around 6 million years, it could be less. It could be less. And so that, in a sense, rather conclusively, I think, gives you an upper boundary for the age of the carving of the present canyon. Mm. So we're looking at 6 for sure, perhaps as little as between 5 and 6.
So this was not just as most people, and everybody, I think, the general public thinks, a gradual decay of the river down through, you know, a period of millions of years. It's a lot more complicated. Things were going up. There was thrusting of tectonics happening, things like that, Ivo, at the same time.
Sure. But really, what fundamentally one has to think of river systems, and this has been one of the great lessons, I think, one has to think of them as competing entities which respond to external circumstances, uplift, glaciers, you name it. Each of these entities is trying to increase its kingdom by a variety of means like headward erosion and what have you. And ultimately, some of these entities, some of these drainages become advantaged by what happens, external causes, and some become disadvantaged. So they're all duking it out, and some of them win out. And what we see today is the result of a long process of such responses to external conditions. Mm. The physical equivalent of biological evolution, I might add.
I see. There was a theory that there was a giant lake, and Richard, you can jump in on this too. There's a giant lake that was around here that spilled over and carried away all kinds of stuff and maybe some of the secrets of the Grand Canyon. Can you tell us about that, Richard?
Well, basically, that was a theory that went back to the 1960s. But we didn't have good age control at that time. But basically, when Ivo and I started working together, he started at the top of the section, kind of with the younger rocks, and I really started at the bottom and worked my way up. So the lake story is really, it really belongs in the younger part of the history rather than where I started at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. And are we ever going to be able to solve the mystery, do you all think, of how old the Grand Canyon is and how it finally was built? Carl, you shaking your head? Yeah, you think we're going to get that?
Well, we've had a number of decadal conferences, collaborative get-togethers of scientists. I think the first one was, what, in the
64.
64, and then in 2000, and then in 2010. And each of these, is that right, Dick, 2000 for the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So each one of these brought together people with very different points of view and different data sets, and I think each decadal meeting has resulted in a giant leap forward. This present one that was just last year, I think there were several really important data sets. So I think, yes, we're honing in on it, and the ability to measure ages better and to look deeply into the earth better and understand river systems better. Mm-hmm. I think we're close.
Well, then Richard, can you tell us then why the Grand Canyon is even here and not some other place along the Colorado River?
Well, I think part of the story that you just finished discussing is the fact that there are hardly any rocks that are between approximately 20 and 6 million years old. So there's a big gap because the rocks are missing. But from my point of view, the country to the west of the plateau and the rocks that I study was much higher, so that the rivers were actually flowing from California, Nevada toward Flagstaff and toward the east. So the system I saw was totally the reverse of what we see today, and gradually that went on for tens of millions of years until approximately maybe 50 million years ago, somewhere in that range. And then we begin to lose track of the details for a period of time, and there's very little evidence.
So 10 to 20 million years ago, that's the fuzzy period.
Well, from say 6 to 20 million
six
years
to
ago,
20.
That's the fuzzy period.
How did the river, why did the river stop moving from going from west to east and then start going in the other direction and the formation of the river and all that kind of stuff?
Can I jump
in?
Go ahead.
We know that the country that used to be mountainous off to the east in the past suddenly dropped precipitously due to Carl's area of expertise, the tectonics of North America, and that's called the Basin and Range Orogeny, roughly 20 million years ago. And that lowered the area to the west, so it made it possible for a river to reverse direction. It's just a question of knowing exactly what the details were.
Carl, do you want to jump in?
Well, I think one of the exciting new data sets is coming along through National Science Foundation telescope. We call it EarthScope, and it's our Hubble telescope, except we don't look up, we look down. And this experiment is imaging the continent of North America at unprecedented resolution. It's going to take us another 10 years to finish it. But the images that are coming out from the EarthScope experiment are showing an Earth's interior that's quite dynamic. And there's upwelling portions of the mantle, and there's downwelling portions of the mantle. And although they're 100 kilometers beneath us, they're exerting forces on the surface, causing the plate to tilt one way and the other, to extend. And it's those dynamic forcings. To me, this is the exciting part about the Grand Canyon, right, is that it's providing a very sensitive record of young and ongoing uplift of the western U.S.
So while it looks to us like it's standing still, it's not standing still.
It's slow, but we have to get the time factor in here. The canyon's getting deeper by about the thickness of that piece of paper every year.
I thought I noticed it there.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about the canyon. Please step up to the mic if you've got a question.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. With Squarespace, you can create a website that's uniquely you, write a blog you've been thinking about, display photos from Flickr, or connect website visitors to your pages on Facebook or Twitter. Choose from hundreds of design templates to get started, plus mobile apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android to update your site on the go. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, you say it easily and with style with Squarespace. Here's a special Sci-Fi offer. Go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account, then use the offer code SCIENCEFRIDAY9 for 10% off for 6 months if you decide to purchase. That's squarespace.com, offer code SCIENCEFRIDAY9. If you're a Sci-Fi listener who uses Squarespace, please let us know. Post a link on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/SciFry. Thank you, Squarespace, for your support of Science Friday.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the origins of the Grand Canyon with my guest, Carl Kallstrom of the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, Eva Lukito, who is from the Museum of Northern Arizona here in Flagstaff, Dick Young of the State University of New York in Geneseo, our number 1-800-989-8255. And when we left talking about this mystery, we were talking about this is a dynamically tectonic active place. In other words, Earth goes up, moves around, changes direction, tilts up, and you can see that in the Grand Canyon. And it makes it hard to decide the exact nature of how things happen here. I heard it described, and it may have been by you in a research paper, as maybe having a, it's like having a cake knife standing still while the cake moves up. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's right. Yeah, that's the way you cut your cake, isn't it? You hold the knife there and lift the cake up.
Sort of. I mean, that's what's going on here with the river. The river is standing, is etching out just enough now as the surrounding area is rising.
Well, and the river's cutting down too. So it's the balance of that. You know, the river would like to reduce the landscape to sea level with enough time, but in this case, the land level I think is moving up as well. So how to quantify those two interacting forces, the erosion that's moving things down and the tectonics that may be moving things up.
Is the tectonics evident around here? Are there, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes and things like that, Ivo?
There's certainly plenty of volcanoes. We're living in the middle of a very active volcanic field. But to go back to what Carl was talking about a little bit, the geomorphic evidence that we see, in other words, the reason why we have canyons as opposed to big, wide, broad, mature valleys is probably because there has been a recent uplift which has caused the river to cut down at a very rapid rate. So it hasn't had time to expand the valley side. It's just cut down. Mm-hmm. So all of those things work together rather nicely to tell us, yes, there has been young uplift.
Mm-hmm. The two big dams on the Colorado, the Glen Canyon Dam and the Hoover Dam, how have they changed the evolution of the river?
Oh, my goodness. Rivers are living things, and they have taught us a great deal about a great many things, including the processes by which they react. Now, a river likes to erode and likes to carry sediment. And it likes to carry a certain amount of sediment, so it is in equilibrium. If you cut off the supply of sediment, the river is hungry, it's angry, it wants to do something with all this energy that it has, and it starts cutting down and transporting some new material down to the sea. Well, when, for example, Glen Canyon Dam was built, people were very much aware of what would happen to the reservoir upstream. But as far as one can tell, they didn't really think enough about what would happen downstream in the Grand Canyon National Park. And national parks are pretty touchy. I mean, you don't mess around with them. So there's been a big to-do about the fact that the beaches are being eroded away. The ecosystem is being changed. And so the big thing has been what to do about that. And a couple of us, Luna Leopold, the famous hydrologist, and I, discovered that by utilizing floods on the Little Colorado River, which happen every 7 years or so, and by adding to that flood some input from the dam to give you enough discharge so that the sand would be part high, one can actually remedy that to a considerable extent. You can never bring it back to the way it was, but you can help.
Is it possible if you don't do anything, the dam is just going to fill up with silt? And a wall is there?
It will.
Sure.
Absolutely.
But, you know, nature has performed this experiment many times in the past with the lava dams that poured over the walls of Grand Canyon and blocked the river, and the river makes pretty short order. We have to get the time scales right. And so tens and hundreds of thousands of years see these dams long gone. So, but at the scale of our human time scales, we have to worry about the silt filling up and dredging the dam, for sure.
Dick Young, did the engineers not know this would happen when they built it?
They did know, and they got the timing pretty right. For example, Lake Mead today at the other end is seriously filling with sediment, and it was projected to have a lifetime of about 100 years, which is kind of approaching us now from the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Wow. They got it right. Let's go to the audience here. Yes.
Hello, my name's Nikki. I'm from the Navajo Nation, and I've always wanted to ask this question on your show, Ira. How do you scientists, and I'm hopefully, Ira, you can answer this too, incorporate Native American indigenous knowledge and science into your work down in the Grand Canyon? Because Powell was not the first one to go through. It was T.O. There was a Hopi and a Navajo boy that actually went through there first. So
okay, let's get set the record straight. Carl, Ivo?
Well, yeah, thanks.
You jumped in. Carl was ready to answer that question. No.
I didn't know that, but it wouldn't surprise me that there had been a lot of people before Powell who had gone down at least parts of the river. The best I can tell you is that in the current studies, the people who are studying the Grand Canyon, monitoring it, and so on and so forth, which I'm not doing anymore, but they do include Navajo and Hopi as stakeholders, as it is said, to make sure that the cultural issues are preserved and the ideas are also incorporated. So the best I can tell you is that, yes, it's a process that's happening.
Carl?
And also, we just finished in October, we opened an exhibit at Grand Canyon, Trail of Time exhibit, to try and communicate to the public a sense of the magnitude of geologic time. Into that exhibit, we were told very early on by some Native Americans that time is not linear, and yet we're doing a timeline. So how to incorporate the concept of cycles and repetition and the interplay between the upper, atmospheric forcings and the Mother Earth forcings. These were all things that are embedded in the exhibit and very powerful concepts that have come, I think, from indigenous science.
All right, thank you. Let's go to this side. Yes.
Well, I'm wondering about the Mexican equivalent to the Grand Canyon. And is that a similar laboratory to the Grand Canyon, or is it just completely different that it perhaps can't apply?
Copper Canyon?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's wider and it's deeper, but it's not as grand, we say. it's not
bigger.
As spectacular in terms of different rock layers that preserve the history of the rock. It's mostly volcanic. It's a spectacular canyon, but carved by a spectacular drainage system as well. So there's lots of lessons from it. I think the Grand Canyon preserves a longer and richer record of the geologic history. And just a comment that at the Grand Canyon we're trying to make clear to people is that it's a relatively young canyon carved into very old rocks. So in the case of Copper Canyon, it's a relatively young canyon carved into relatively young rocks.
When you go to the Grand Canyon, you see layers, wonderful layers upon layers of different colored rocks, which the river has cut into. What is the age of those rocks up there?
Oh, the top ones are 270 million, and then as you go down, they get older. And the oldest rocks that we've dated in the inner gorge of Grand Canyon is almost 2 billion, 1.84 billion years.
And so jump in our time machine and take us ahead to a couple of million years.
Well, but that's only half the age of the Earth, of course, 2 billion. So we,
right.
But okay, now jump ahead. As I say, it's getting deeper, about a thickness of a piece of paper every year, and the river's carving down and the landscape's moving up. So I would hazard a guess that the Grand Canyon's getting grander.
Probably, for sure. But, you know, this is a good time to introduce an idea that a lot of people don't really understand. What is a million years? Mm-hmm. How many people have a physical understanding of what a million years is? A good way of doing that is, I think, to bring in human life. Assume that the human generation is 20 years. Good enough. Easy number to work with. So how many generations between us and Christ? 100. How many generations between us and the time when Bronze Age Troy was sacked and burned, as described by Homer? 160. How many years between us and the time when people in Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates, invented agriculture and invented urban living and gave rise to the civilization we have today? Well, that's about 300. How many generations in a million years? 50,000.
That's a long time.
And that's, you see?
But not in Earth time. It's not.
No. 1 million year for us geologists is chump change.
No, that's the heart.
But it's 50,000 generations, and that explains why you can carve Grand Canyons in 5 million years.
Yeah. Creationists have jumped on some of these problems that still need to be solved, and they say, this proves creationism. I mean, how do you react to that, Carl? When you go out to the Grand Canyon, go on a raft, and you go to a spot, and you describe it, and then someone else comes along and say, "Oh, this is carved out by Noah's flood."
Yeah, the next river trip behind us could be creationists talking about the same rocks with a different set of stories. They view the horizontal layers in Grand Canyon as Noah's flood rocks, and the ones in the basement as the ones that God created in the first days. It's a difficult one to address. I think the Grand Canyon gets visitors from all over the world with all different creation stories about how humans originated, and scientists operate a little differently. Our scientists operate with data, with testing of evidence, with refinement. The arguments that go on between scientists are to refine the ages, not to presume any particular answer from the beginning. So it's just a different way of approaching your belief system, and we think science is the one to. The park agrees; they're presenting the scientific interpretation of Grand Canyon as the one which the public deserves to hear.
Dick Young, any comment?
Well, I don't. Fortunately, being out in the Western Canyon with the Hualapai Indians, I have not encountered too many creationists. It's too hot and dry out there.
Let's go to the audience. Yes, man.
I was wondering if, do you know if the Grand Canyon would ever completely erode?
When you say completely erode, what do you mean by that?
Like not exist anymore.
Okay. Dick Young, you want to take a shot at that first?
Good question.
Well, I guess only if we build enough dams to fill it up, as we started to do, but I think that's not an issue anymore since they defeated the last dam that was in my field area.
Evo? Yeah.
Well, what happens is with time, the river will carve, well, erosion will carve the sides of the canyon or the valley back and back and back and back, and the river will transport the debris that's produced by this down to the sea. How fast this happens is very variable, depends on the rock that you're dealing with, depends on the energy of the stream, and so on and so forth. But one thing is for sure, and that is, in time, the Grand Canyon will not be a canyon anymore. Maybe it'll be a wide-open valley.
Huh. Will it find on its own a way around these dams before that time?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, this is an interesting thing. If you look at Glen Canyon Dam from below, you notice, and many of us have noticed, that there are some big springs developing on the right abutment of the dam that didn't used to be there. And big blocks of rock are falling down. Now, the abutment is in a sandstone which is cemented with calcite, calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate is soluble in acid. The water of the lake is weakly acid. So guess what happens? It's a self-reinforcing mechanism. The more solution happens, the more water goes through, the more solutions. So it is possible that at some time, perhaps not too far from today, there would be a big plug of concrete sitting there with a river going around it, maybe on both sides.
Good tourist attraction.
Think of that for wonderful.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. You sort of revel in nature triumphing over humans, don't you? I mean, you like that the big plug of
no, we humans disaster. Do natural stupid things all the time.
Carl,
yeah, we have to keep in mind the time frames, and this whole discussion is great to think about the things that geologists can help society with that are at human time scales for my lifetime, for my children's lifetime, versus the processes that we need to think of over longer periods of time. That's what geosciences have to offer, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this young man in the audience.
Well, so there's lots of caves in the Grand Canyon, like around it, so how might they have formed?
How did the caves form in the Grand Canyon? Good question.
The cave systems are, for the most part, in the limestone layers, and just as Eva was describing, these weakly acid waters will move down through a crack and expand the crack into a room, and then eventually the rooms can be linked together into vast cave systems. And once that happens, then our groundwater finds its way through the caves. And so if you want to find a lot of water out on the plateau, you have to somehow figure out where the water is flowing through these cave systems. And it's a great challenge, but it's one of the main aquifers for the Colorado Plateau, which is the place where the water can be found if you could find the crack systems.
You're not suggesting he go out and find those?
Well, he may want to. He may want
water,
to.
Water in the
That'd
cave.
Be fun.
He sounds like he's interested in caves.
One more question here. Yes.
Hi. I was wondering if you could explain what the effect has been of past polar shifts on the geology of this area and also globally, and also what the anticipated effect of the current polar shift will have with the polar north being over Siberia.
So there's a couple of, I guess, a question back for you. Are you talking about magnetic reversals where the North Pole becomes the South Pole? It happens intermittently in Earth history?
Correct.
There's also another thing where the called secular variation, where the north magnetic pole moves around a little bit relative to the where Santa Claus lives, the rotational pole.
Very scientific terms are used.
Yeah. To my knowledge, no one has demonstrated a direct effect between the reversals in the magnetic fields and, say, extinctions or events in terms of geomorphic features. So the Earth's core is churning away with a convective system that generates the magnetic field. It doesn't seem to have a direct effect, to my knowledge, of the surface system.
You're shaking your head, same thing?
Well, I'm just saying, nor do we know of any correlation with, for example, tectonics, which would be something you could conceivably see.
Could a big tectonic event just plug up the Grand Canyon somewhere?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose so. A great big fault or something, yeah.
There are major faults in the Western Grand Canyon that the river's actually very powerful and able to carry away the debris over short periods of time. There have also been huge landslides in Grand Canyon.
But they get cleaned out.
They get cleaned out, yeah.
All right. I want to thank you both, all three of you gentlemen, for taking time to join us. It's fascinating. Learned everything about the Grand Canyon. Carl Kallstrom, Professor of Structural Geology and Tectonics at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Ivo Lukita, who is an emeritus scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey. He's also a research associate at the Museum of Northern Arizona here in Flagstaff. Ivo, thanks for joining us today. And Richard Dick Young is a professor of geological sciences at the State University of New York in Geneseo. Carl, Ivo, Richard, thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
¿Hablas español? Then check out our science news in Spanish at sciencefriday.com/Spanish.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. What comes to mind when you think of the Wild West? Of course, dusty cowboys, miners, saloons, six guns. How about astronomy? Because back in the 1890s, the mathematician and astronomer Percival Lowell sent a scout out west, away from the city lights of the East Coast, to find the perfect spot for a new observatory. His scout started down in Tombstone, Arizona, slowly working his way up the state, and he eventually made it to Flagstaff, then just a little outpost of around 800 people, selecting a mesa above the town as the ideal place for the new Lowell Observatory. And in the years since, they have made some remarkable discoveries at Lowell, like the planet X, a.k.a. Pluto, and other observations that eventually led to development of the Big Bang Theory and the idea that the universe is expanding. And they're still busy discovering stuff today, still hunting for planets, but not ones in our solar system, new exoplanets. And they're studying our sun and other stars like it and planning for a flyby of Pluto. So there's a lot to talk about, a lot of stuff going on here at the Lowell. And here to talk about it is Jeffrey Hall, astronomer and director of the Lowell Observatory here in Flagstaff. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for that tour you gave me last night.
That was fun.
I didn't realize how hands-on it is to work that telescope.
It is. It's a 106-year-old telescope at this point. Manually operated. It's open every night for people who come to Lowell for observing, and our staff just slew it around manually.
That's true. And it has a pie pan on it, a frying pan on it.
That's right. One of the finder scopes, they couldn't figure out what to use for a cap, so why not the director's wife's frying pan?
High-tech, truly high-tech stuff. Let's talk about Lowell himself. Why was he so anxious to get the telescope built?
Well, Lowell is a mathematician by training, astronomer by passion, and he had become very interested in what he thought was evidence of intelligent life on Mars, the so-called canals. And in 1894, there was a particularly favorable opposition or a geometric alignment of Earth and Mars that made it favorable for observing. So he was pretty anxious to get away from the humid, cloudy east and out here to the dry, barren west to found a new observatory and make those observations.
And so he chose Flagstaff because?
After a long tour through the Arizona Territory, it was probably some combination of fortunately clear skies when his scout, Mr. Douglas, was here, good treatment by the locals and willingness to give the observatory a site of land up on what was called Site 11 and where we still are 117 years later, just about a mile from here.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Pluto being discovered here at Lowell. Tell us the story behind that.
Well, Percival Lowell was convinced there was a planet X out beyond Neptune, which he believed was because of irregularities in the motions of Uranus and Neptune. It turns out that wasn't the case, but in fact, when the Pluto search was resumed in earnest, quite some time after Lowell's death, in fact, it was found fortuitously fairly close to where he predicted it would be in 1930.
Wow, and one of the things he was involved with while he was alive was the observations of so-called spiral nebula galaxies, right?
Yes, and you know, we're certainly most famous for the discovery of Pluto, but really the much more profound astronomical discovery is just that. Back in 1912, we had only the most rudimentary idea of what might be beyond our solar system and the structure of the universe. The idea that spiral nebulae might be other, well, they picturesquely called them island universes, perhaps systems of spinning stars out beyond our own galaxy, but it was speculation. Lowell directed one of the observatory's astronomers, Vesto Slipher, to make observations of these using that telescope you looked through last night with a spectrograph attached to it, and he found that the spectral lines in these spiral nebulae were all redshifted, and these were the first cosmological redshifts. At the time, they didn't know what they were looking at, but they were the first observations that ultimately led to the idea that the universe is expanding. It's one of the fundamental observations of the 20th century.
And that's what Edwin Hubble ran with, right?
Mm-hmm.
To talk about the redshift and expansion of
the universe. That then developed into the expanding universe cosmology.
So this is this Edwin. Hubble was one of the founders of this theory. How many times did he come up to Lowell to take a look?
Slipher's work was picked up by the folks over in California.
And, so he never came here?
Not that I know of.
And still credited with that incredible discovery about using the data that came from here.
As with many discoveries like this, it's a lengthy process. We still see this today. You have discoveries where knowledge is an incremental process, and it often takes a team or a group of people to eventually come to the right answer.
If you'd like to ask a question, our microphones are open here in the hall. Don't be afraid to step up and ask. And would you say that was probably the most famous use of the telescope in long term were these observations?
The Clark telescope has been used for a number of things. Today it's for public viewing. It was not, in fact, the telescope used to discover Pluto. That's a different one, not more optimized for wide field surveys. But certainly with the Clark, that's pretty fundamental.
Did they have any idea at the time when they were talking about, when Lowell was talking about these spiral nebulae, where our place in the galaxy was?
No. The development of the understanding of the structure of our galaxy, the structure of the universe, is within pretty much the last century.
And one of the projects the observatory is involved in today is the New Horizons spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Well, that is an unmanned NASA spacecraft on its way to Pluto. It was launched in 2006. And one of the main criteria for this mission is the folks who launched it really didn't want to be dead by the time it got to Pluto.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. So the idea is you build a very small, very light spacecraft and put it on the biggest rocket we've got and really fling it out there. So they launched it in 2006. 13 months later, they used the old gravitational slingshot past Jupiter, and now it is on its way to a 2015 rendezvous with Pluto, and if we can find a suitable object, they will continue on to try to get a close-up image of one of the enigmatic Kuiper Belt objects that populates the far reaches of the solar system.
And so your observatory is involved in that research.
One of our astronomers, Will Grundy, is a member of the New Horizons science team, and like any of these missions, it's a large consortium of scientists from multiple institutions.
But Pluto is still very special.
Oh, here. We love Pluto.
And so any chance you get to do some research with Pluto?
Well, I think it's singularly appropriate. And, you know, what are we going to find when we get to Pluto? What I've heard him say is, we don't know, but it's guaranteed to surprise us. And in that regard, It's just like the other unmanned missions. Think back to the Pioneer and the Voyager era when we got our first close-up look at the moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus. They're weird.
Yeah.
All of them are pathological in one way or another. So I'm sure that when we get there, we'll find something pretty interesting.
Speaking of pathological, let's go to the audience. No. Sorry about that. Yes, first question here.
I wanted to ask about the dark skies because I know... Mm-hmm. Flagstaff is a dark sky city, and I know that from some points outside of town you can see the light pollution from Phoenix and other big cities. And what part has Lowell had in keeping the skies of Flagstaff dark?
We've had about a 50-year role in that, going back that far when there was first some indications that brightly lit advertising might be put in place in Flagstaff. And this started an effort really to work with the city and the citizens, not at them, to come up with a solution that provides safe and sensible lighting for people on the ground while preserving the beauty of the night sky, not only for astronomers, but even from in Flagstaff. We were looking last night, yeah. Just standing outside the Clark Telescope, you can look up 1 mile from downtown Flagstaff, and there's the Milky Way galaxy in all of its splendor. That's a good thing to have in the middle of a reasonably sized city. Chris Luganbuhl at the United States Naval Observatory has done some quantitative work on this, and I think the answer he got is that the skies in Flagstaff are about 30% darker than they would be in the absence of an ordinance. Other communities around Arizona have picked up the torch, as it were, although that might be a lousy analogy. And you know, it's really a statewide effort because astronomy is a huge industry in Arizona. $250 million a year pumped into the state economy and growing as new opportunities come in. So preservation of the quality of our skies, both for science as well as for public enjoyment, is quite important. And Flagstaff has been an international leader in this regard.
Well, what does the ordinance say? You're not allowed to what? Or
There's a couple of components to it. It basically limits the lumens per acre. And then there are zones, lighting zones, where it's a little more strict in the areas closest to the observatories, and then gradually relaxes as you get a little farther away.
Well, it certainly seems to be working.
It's working well, yeah.
In this city. Let's go to this gentleman here. Yes.
So you're talking about detecting exoplanets and the search for exoplanets,
yeah.
And I know it has to do with detecting the dimming of stars, and I was wondering if you could talk more about the process that goes into finding an exoplanet.
Sure. We have an astronomer on our staff who's involved with the Kepler mission, which is out there staring at a region of sky in the constellation Cygnus, searching for planets. That finding exoplanets is a fairly recent development because they're very hard to see. You know, they're small, faint. They tend to be washed out by the brilliant star next to them. So only recently have we developed the instrumentation that can find them. There's a couple of ways you can look for them. You can look for mini eclipses. If you happen to have a star where the planet passes in front of the star, you get a very small dip, sort of like a solar eclipse, except it's not like the moon over the sun. It's this little blip. That's kind of what Kepler is doing. They're looking for brightness variations in stars to detect the existence of planets. You can also do a little bit of it's almost like the redshift work. You can look at spectral lines from the star altering or going back and forth a little bit as a planet tugs the star back and forth. And then one way that's very difficult to do is just try to take a picture and image it directly. We have astronomers at Lowell who have been involved with teams employing all three of those techniques. What we're finding, you know, in some ways, Ira, we're almost on a cusp, very similar to where I think Slipher might have been in 1912. We had an idea that there were things out there, spiral right. nebulae, but we didn't know what they were, and we hadn't detected many of them. But now, as we start to look for planets, they're everywhere. We're up to about 700 of them wherever we look. And we're starting to get the picture of a galaxy that's just brimming with worlds. Now, by and large, if you're really looking to get away from it all and do an exoplanet vacation, say, the ones we've found so far are horrible. You know, they're the gas giant-sized, very close to their parent stars, 2,200-degree atmospheres. Ugh, you can't even think about it. But missions like Kepler, now have the ability and the precision to detect ever smaller planets that are more Earth-like. And the real Holy Grail is a planet in the habitable zone around a sun-like star. This is a planet where water can exist in all three of its phases and potentially a source for life as we know it.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Plato here in Flagstaff, talking about the Lowell Observatory. And you guys also do research on the sun.
I do.
And what do you want to know about the sun? What are you thinking about?
Well, we want to know if it's going to destroy us all. No. I came to Lowell involved in a project designed to do long-term monitoring of the solar activity cycle and similar activity cycles in stars like the sun. The idea being the sun influences terrestrial climate. We know it does weird things. The cycle seems to turn off or go into very quiescent periods from time to time. What effect might that have on terrestrial climate? The problem is, first of all, Ivo points out that a million years is chump change. We're astronomers, okay? 10 million years is chump change for us. And by that point, I'm going to be thoroughly sick of this project. So instead of observing one star for 10 million years, we observe a whole bunch of the most solar-like stars we can. Now, imagine looking out at this audience. Imagine understanding the human race by observing one person. You know, you'd have a very myopic view. We use other suns as proxies for our own to understand how the sun might have varied over hundreds to thousands, millions of years.
Mm-hmm. That question. Oh, it's a familiar face. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Brian.
Hi, Jeff. Can you share with us about the capacity of the new Discovery Telescope and when it's going to be working? And
Brian, I would love to share that with you.
We did not set this up in advance.
I
didn't. I know these guys were doing.
And I honestly don't know about it.
Yeah.
Tell us this new telescope for what's it about?
I just got back from that telescope where I was giving some folks a tour. Astronomers do what they do by collecting light. You know, we can't go out and dig in the ground, and we can't put a star in a beaker and poke it. We collect light, and so we need light buckets. Lowell's currently largest telescope has a mirror of 1.8 meters aperture. That's about 6 feet across. Not too bad, but small by today's standards. The Discovery Channel telescope is a 4.3 meter primary mirror, about 14 feet across. State-of-the-art instrumentation. Why is it called what it is? Mr. John Hendricks is the founder and CEO of Discovery Communications. Contributed through his own foundation and Discovery $16 million towards the capital cost of the telescope, jump-started the project back in 2003 in return for naming rights. And what Discovery wants to do is not tell us what to look at, but use what we look at to use in their broadcasts. So we and our partners will use this fabulous new facility to observe things we just can't do right now. You know, we have public tours every day at Lowell, and often people will ask, how far can you see with your telescope? And really, it's more, how faint can you see? Mm-hmm. Like these Kuiper Belt objects, celestially speaking, they're right on our doorstep, but they're small, and many of them are not very reflective, so they're exquisitely faint.
So you'll be able to see that with this
right,
telescope.
Right. We can do imaging and even more difficult spectroscopic studies where you spread the light out of very faint objects. And you go out there and stand out there. I think if Percival Lowell were standing there, you remember the Clark Telescope Dome last night?
Yes,
and
yes.
All around the perimeter are these tires.
Right.
The 1954 Ford pickup tires that rotate the dome. You go out to the Discovery Channel Telescope. In the dome at 90-degree intervals are these huge motors. And underneath the motors are these really high-tech tires. They're very high-tech. And they butt up against this immense steel ring and turn the dome. In aspect, they look very similar to the old things. I think if Lowell were standing out there, he'd be pretty happy.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming by and telling us about that.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Hall is an astronomer and director of the Lowell Observatory here in Flagstaff.